Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Missing Frames. This is the podcast where we watch all the movies we should have seen by this point in our lives. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. We are hanging out on thenerdparty.com. That is just a network of podcasts. You've got movies, you've got TV, you've got Star Trek, Star Wars, Doctor Who, Harry Potter. There's all sorts of stuff going on. Check it out at thenerdparty.com. You can follow us on Twitter at @JoinNerdParty, like the Facebook page, The Nerd Party, and it's also at The Nerd Party on Instagram. And I am so thrilled to welcome back to the show a gentleman who's not been on for far too long, and that is Scott Russell. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much, Sean. Missed you.
I know, I miss you too. We are going to be watching a movie that Scott has not seen. This is Hayao Miyazaki's Princess Mononoke, which is one of, I think, the greatest films of all time, not just animated, but in general. I am also a huge Miyazaki fan, so I'm biased. But Scott, you are a Miyazaki fan too, wouldn't you say?
I would say so. Definitely still in the process of becoming one. But, you know, I'm well aware of his reputation as one of the greats in animation. And have dipped my toe into Studio Ghibli's catalog a bit. You know, obviously I know it extends beyond just Hayao, but I think I've mostly watched his stuff so far specifically.
That's a lot of what I've seen too. I don't know if I've seen many other Ghibli movies that aren't Miyazaki. I just love him so much. I'm afraid to have my heart broken if I watch a Ghibli movie that's not directed by him. And it's just like, oh, it was fine.
Yeah, you don't want to break the spell.
It was kind of the equivalent of whenever Disney would release an animated film in that time period and it wasn't Pixar. I would be like, oh, but I just don't care because it's not Pixar. That's kind of how I feel about Pixar. Ghibli. Yeah, it's kind of how I feel about Ghibli and Miyazaki, which is probably not fair at all. I probably have plenty of missing frames I should do for other Ghibli movies. But what are some of the Miyazaki movies that you have seen, and which ones have you enjoyed the most?
So I lucked into seeing Kiki's Delivery Service at a very young age, and I have really fond memories of that. That was like, you know, I have been watching it on VHS at that point. So long time. I don't remember that one well. Been meaning to rewatch it for a very long time, but I've seen Spirited Away. You know, that was when recently I've been trying to dig into all my Studio Ghibli blind spots. That was obviously where I started, you know, which may or may not
have been wise. So that was a recent viewing?
Yeah, I think within the past year or two. And I was just blown away by that. And it's always so satisfying when something that's held up as a high point of an art form lives up to the hype. So that was really great. I'd say that's got to be my favorite, other than the soft spot I've got for Kiki's. I've also watched some of the, you know, relatively more minor ones in the past year or two, like Howl's Moving Castle, Nausicaa. Oh, just saw Totoro for the first time, like,
oh yes,
2 weeks ago, and was delighted.
Yeah, Totoro is wonderful. I did that as a Missing Frames episode with my friend Brad Gullickson, who does the In the Mouth of Darkness podcast, and he does the Comic Book Couples Counseling podcast. He's got too many podcasts. The Rest in Pictures podcast. He's doing too much. Brad, you're making me look bad. But he and I, Brad is not a big Miyazaki fan. And I was like, well, let's try My Neighbor Totoro, because it's just like, Totoro's different. It's not necessarily plot driven. It's very like mood and atmosphere driven.
Sure.
And I wondered if he would maybe appreciate that a little more. And he did. He enjoyed it. But Spirited Away is not only my favorite of Miyazaki's films, that's like top 10 favorite films of all time. I adore that film. But Princess Mononoke is the first film of his I'd ever seen. And okay. I, growing up, I got really into anime, like in my late middle school, early high school years. Like, it started with Pokemon, and then it transitioned into Digimon, which I think that proves just how much of a nerd I am, that I was obsessed with Digimon.
I followed that same track.
So you understand, but I
didn't make it to Yu-Gi-Oh, but I was definitely in for Yu-Gi-Oh. Digimon.
Yeah, by Yu-Gi-Oh, I was like, all right, I need to jump off this bandwagon.
That's right.
Now. But I remember starting to explore the world of anime, and it was always, because it always was like, this style of animation is so unique and different. I didn't know why. I didn't realize it was, oh, it's Japan. Oh, it came from Japan. And once I started to delve into anime, I started to learn more about what the genre was, how it like came to fruition, and what the major like milestones in the genre were. So one of the first, I think the first real anime I ever saw was Akira. Oof. Which have you seen that?
Yeah, I saw that for the first time relatively recently as well, and that wrecked me. That made my brain explode.
Akira is fantastic.
Yeah, that was incredible.
That was, I mean, not to insult Pokemon and if you guys, I know my the listeners out there are like, how dare you throw those under the bus? I know they're the prime example of visual storytelling for sure. I'm not arguing that. But what I am gonna say is, I think Akira was my first exposure to like real, actual, like artistically sound anime. It was the first.
Devastatingly impactful, you know, like,
yes,
the power of that movie. It's an unfair comparison, obviously, but
you don't think Pikachu can stand a chance against Tetsuo?
Maybe Detective Pikachu.
But it's true. I mean, Akira, not only in my life but in general, is such a landmark in the world of anime was so cheap, and it was kind of crudely done in some cases, and Akira went out of its way to be like a big budget, like very meticulously detailed animated film. And I think it's a really great place to start. Princess Mononoke was the second anime film that I saw. It was one of those where after I saw Akira, a lot of my friends, a lot of older kids I knew at school were kind of like, all right, well, now you got to watch Princess Mononoke. You got to get into that one. So it was in the back of my mind, and it was only a few years after it had been released, and it had been talked about enough. Like Roger Ebert had named it one of his top 10 films of that year. It had been talked about enough that I knew about it in the back of my mind. I mean, it was the biggest film in Japan until Titanic, I think, beat it. So I'd heard a lot about it, and I knew enough to know that it was like, okay, this is a movie I have to see. So we ended up renting it, and I watched it. And the first time I watched it, it didn't really like get me in the same way Akira did. Akira is just such a visceral, like violent and like insane experience. I think I was hoping for that. And Princess Mononoke is Miyazaki. It's thoughtful. It's a little bit slower. It's more poetic,
right.
And stunning. I don't think I was ready for that. I was kind of like, this is fine, I think, but I preferred Akira. And then a couple years later, I think I was at like a family reunion at a beach house, and my cousin had brought Princess Mononoke with him, and he just put it on for his parents. Like, he was kind of like, I swear, you know, even though it's animated, this is actually like a really sophisticated, really beautiful film. And he put it on, and I know they kind of walked out of the room almost immediately, but I sat there kind of like, well, I guess I'll watch this again. And I just remember being like floored, like completely blown away. One of those situations where you saw a movie and you thought you knew what you thought about it. It was one of those situations where I was like, what the hell was I thinking? This is brilliant. This is beautiful. This is insane. I love this.
How long was it between viewings, did you say?
Maybe like a year. It wasn't that long, but it was like, I don't know what changed in my brain,
it
hit different. And I completely fell in love, and you know, Spirited Away came out not long after that, and I went and saw that in theaters and loved that, and eventually just would go through Miyazaki's entire library. But that was kind of my Mononoke. I don't want to spoil anything for you, obviously. This is where you're about to watch it for the first time.
Yes.
Princess Mononoke, I think, is even to this day kind of an outlier in Miyazaki's filmography.
I have some inkling of why that might be.
Well, what do you know about it? Tell me what you know about it.
In the most general sense, I'm aware that it's held up as one of the, you know, obviously Spirited Away is kind of the consensus top Miyazaki, but I have gotten the impression over the years that Mononoke is not far behind, you know, right up there on the podium.
Yes.
And my brother Ryan, who's a massive Studio Ghibli fan, you know, he's the one who kind of pointed me in that direction of late, and he's talked to me about his thoughts on all these movies and, you know, all these ideas that they're juggling. You know, he's given me that really clear sense of what Miyazaki is interested in and the kind of themes that he tends to tackle. And that was what really kind of got my appetite up to run through these movies. But the impression that he gave me of Mononoke was just that it's, you know, an outlier, whereas something like Totoro is a lot more, you know, wholesome and sweet and could be a great kids movie. I get the impression that Mononoke is not that it's more, you know, it's no Akira, but it's more adult, it's more dark, it's more violent. That's kind of the general impression he's given me. But plot wise, I couldn't tell you word one. I imagine there's a princess involved. You know, I've seen stills of a big wolf. That's literally all I know. Plot wise.
That's a good place to start. Well, no, Ryan is right. Like it is, we also, by the way, we both have a brother named Ryan.
Is that right?
Does that mean weird related?
Probably.
Well, now that we've cleared that up. yes. So Miyazaki, obviously a running theme through all his films is the relationship between man and nature.
Of course.
And very much a lifting up of like nature is something that should be cherished and appreciated and loved in a way that it isn't. Really,
right.
Mononoke, I haven't looked too much into it, partly because I didn't want to talk about it beforehand. Mononoke feels like it comes from a place of anger and pessimism. It's not like it's not that it's a hopeless film. It is not a depressing film, but it feels much more cynical than what Miyazaki had made up to this point in his career. Like I mean, My Neighbor Totoro. Castle in the Sky, Kiki's Delivery Service, Porco Rosso. All these films are... Porco Rosso was the film before this, and it's not like... I wouldn't call it an adult film, but it's a little bit more mature than his other work, but it's not on the level of Princess Mononoke. And Princess Mononoke comes from a place that feels like Miyazaki was kind of fed up with sort of the hippy-dippy, like, everything's wonderful and isn't nature beautiful and da-da-da. It feels like he was really... going for the throat with this one. The themes are there, but this comes from, like you said, it's a more adult film. It's definitely not something I think would be appropriate for kids. You'll know pretty early on, you'll be like, oh yeah, it feels a little bit more brutal, a little bit more pessimistic, but it retains the same, that sense of spirituality, that sense of beauty and the recognition of that. In a grander scale than I think Miyazaki had ever done up to this point in his career, and I think has ever done since. A lot of his films are very intimate and very focused on fantastical elements, but also just like a lot of times it's like a Spirited Away, a girl trying to save her parents. They've been turned into pigs. She's got to navigate this world of like magic and spirits and figure out how to get back to her world. So it's these almost fairy tale elements. Princess Mononoke retains that sense of magic and mystical beauty, but at the same time, it carries within it this core of, I think, Miyazaki's general frustration with the world. I feel like we get a really interesting glimpse into Miyazaki's mindset that is maybe a little bit more bare than we've seen throughout his filmography.
That makes me fascinated to see it, without question. I mean, you know, he's clearly... a man with some pretty serious issues on his mind, and he thinks deeply about them through his films and, you know, is obviously a very passionate person about, you know, these concepts like nature and family and et cetera. And I would like to see someone like that, you know, off the leash and really sort of just letting fly with something a little less, you know, easily palatable. But that, you know, kind of balance you were discussing a minute ago between telling just these kind of emotion-driven family stories versus introducing supernatural elements and, you know, making more of like high fantasy almost. That was something that I was really struck by in Totoro, is how heavily that movie actually leans on just the story of a family, you know, with a sick mother and moving the young girls into a new house, you know, like Totoro, I don't think shows up until like minute 60, you know, I was kind of surprised by that.
Yeah, it's a movie that takes you off guard. Mononoke is very, I think it was interesting going back and watching My Neighbor Totoro after seeing Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away. Those are very plot-driven movies. And I think earlier in his career, Miyazaki was way more driven, again, by what does it feel like? Like, it wasn't so much about there's something driving this story. It was about the beauty of the relationship between these girls and their father, the relationship they had with their sick mother, and again, the way Totoro and nature and the spirit of the forest plays this integral role in their lives. And those are themes that are in Princess Mononoke. It's now coming from a place of like the kid gloves are off. let's talk. Let's sit down and have a serious talk. And that's, again, not a knock against My Neighbor Totoro, which is a beautiful film. I think Princess Mononoke, it has a very strong point of view and it's not playing around, and it's Miyazaki really. I'm very excited to see what you think about it. So all you know, it's a story about there's a princess and there's a wolf in it. That's all we know.
Yeah. Yeah. That's about it. I mean, from, you know, stills I've seen just floating across the internet, I get the impression that she's a princess in a pretty warlike culture. You know, you see the red face paint, you see the spear. It definitely seems like she's going to be doing some clobbering. Beyond that, I haven't gleaned any specifics of the plot. So I'm excited to see, you know, what kind of conflict she's going to be part of.
Perfect. Let's break to watch it, and we will come back to see whether or not it lives up to your expectations.
Sounds like a plan.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. Scott, tell me, what did you think of Princess Mononoke?
Oh, man. I was blown away by it. I was really, like, overwhelmed.
And you watched it twice. And I was like, well, that tells me something.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to get both the subs and dubs experience. And, you know, it's just such a dense movie. There's a lot more plot than I was expecting. And it was really helpful to be able to take a second run at that. But I also was just wanting to savor it for another 2 hours and 14 minutes.
I think this is a Missing Frames first. I think you are the first person in the history of Missing Frames to watch the movie twice. How does that make you feel? I think it was a good choice too. It's been a few years since I last watched it, and again, I was just completely blown away by the film, as you were, but even on my, God, I don't know how many times I've seen it, but it's just as powerful and just as affecting, and there's so many layers to peel back and so many things to appreciate. But like you said, the first thing that you really notice, and I think why it was strange trying to go back for me when I started getting into Miyazaki, going back to some of his earlier films like Kiki's Delivery Service or My Neighbor Totoro, right, is the lack of plot to them. Like I was so used to, I wanted every movie of his to be Princess Mononoke, which is this big epic tale with, like, you know, with big stakes and things like that. But I realized as I was watching it, I kept comparing it in my mind to The Lord of the Rings and Tolkien. And it has that sense of epic scope. And then it occurred to me, you asked me in the first part of the episode, what changed between my first viewing of the film, where I didn't particularly love it, and my second viewing of the film, when I all of a sudden was like, this is one of the best movies I've ever seen, and I couldn't remember. And as I was watching and thinking about the Tolkien comparisons, I realized what had happened was between the first and second time I saw it, the first Lord of the Rings movie had come out. And that was my favorite film. And it's no wonder why the second time I saw Princess Mononoke, it clicked with me, because I do think it's kind of in that same vein.
It's definitely got that same, like, epic scope, and, you know, the whole, like, hero's journey sort of framework, I think, applies to this for sure.
It definitely does. And the same kind of it's a bit more angry, it's a bit more cynical, it feels less fantastical, even though there are a lot of elements of mysticism and magical creatures and there's the spirit of the forest and da da da. It feels somehow more grounded than even some of Miyazaki's legitimately grounded films prior to this. Mononoke feels like not only a breath of fresh air, but it feels strangely gloomy in a way, almost from the get-go. You have this character, the main character is wounded at the start by this horrific demon, and his tribe is essentially like, well, you're dead to us, you have to go on a journey, and we banish you. And it's like, well,
yeah, it's pretty brutal and unsparing that way, particularly the way that the wise woman, referred to as the oracle in the subtitled version, tells him what's going to happen as a result of the wound, when she's like, it will hurt you until it kills you.
Yes. You'll be in extreme pain and then you'll die. And it's like, well, okay.
I love that the good guys are under siege from the very beginning. I love how it almost starts sort of in media res after you get that brief, you know, sort of table setting, you know, minute or two. And then right away, Nago, like the cursed Nago, is attacking. But I agree that that was one of the things I really responded to, was just how unforgiving it is. There's really no, this is not a movie at all interested in coddling you or, you know, giving you any kind of easy answer of any kind. It puts Ashitaka behind the eight ball from the very beginning. And then I feel like he's kind of the compass needle at the center of this movie, who's just trying to figure out what's right and what he needs to do. You know, he's told, find the source of this iron ball that turned Nago into a demon. And that's kind of all the direction he's really given at the outset. And he has to keep kind of reevaluating his moral judgment of the characters that he meets. And, you know, his allegiances are kind of shifting as it goes. And it's really interesting that he seems kind of blank in a way. He's just sort of flatly noble. And he gets to encounter these characters and kind of size up their motivations and try to find which side he's on. And in a way, he's on everyone's side.
Yeah, it's interesting. I like that you bring that up. He is, I think, on the surface, kind of like that bland stoic character that we see in so many popular heroes' journeys, like Star Wars with Luke Skywalker or Harry Potter or things like that. I think where Ashitaka gets the layers and what makes him compelling is the curse he has. You are immediately made to empathize with him and to feel for him. Like, you're like, this guy just, he basically ended his life. He ended the life he knew, and his life is over because he did the right thing. He was protecting his village, and now he's cursed for it. His village can't even cut him some slack and say, hey, we'll make up a nice room for you. And in that way, I think it's a brilliant move on Miyazaki's part. Because like you said, Ashitaka spends the rest of the film kind of being sort of just the paragon of virtue. He goes into every situation and is consistently like, people are like, whose side are you on? And he's like, I'm not on any side. I just want everyone to do the right thing. And everyone's like, okay. And the movie, I think something that threw me off when I first saw it as well, that I appreciated more and continue to appreciate as I watch it, every time I watch it, is the ambiguity. There's no sense that anyone is particularly right or wrong in the film. So there's the bullet or the iron ball he gets from Nago that leads him to Lady Eboshi, who you are like, all right, this is the bad guy. This is the antagonist of the film. Nope. Her ideals are a bit twisted. She's not sensitive to the fact that she's kind of destroying the forest and killing everybody. But she has her own personal moral code. She's protecting her people. She wants to give them the best possible life and potentially save these lepers that she's hosting by using the blood of the spirit of the forest.
I think she's the most morally complicated character in the whole film. She's just got such an interesting set of principles and motivations. And I agree completely that, you know, the lepers and these women that she's freed from brothels and pressed into service, you know, helping to make the iron, and that whole society that she has in Irontown is very progressive in a way. And, you know, she's looking out for these people who don't really have a place elsewhere in society, and that all is very sympathetic. But like you say, she's set against nature in a way that makes it really hard to just fully support her as a character.
And I think the closest thing we have to a villain is probably Jigo. He represents the mysterious emperor who we never see and never meet. We just meet all the pawns. I think that's very interesting that we're just meeting all these people who are almost, you know, we see the gods, we see the spirits of the forest, the mystical creatures, we see them, they exist. The emperor is the only entity that we don't see. Like, how interesting that, something who that is placed in reality as a leader, that is this thing that everyone is fighting over, he never appears in the film. I find that very interesting that this force is driving everything that happens and never shows up.
I would imagine that's deliberate on Miyazaki's part, because I mean this is a big long film. You know, this is like the infamous Miyazaki sending a sword to Harvey Weinstein and saying no cuts. You know, like he wanted to put everything he possibly could into this thing. And I imagine,
can you imagine if Weinstein wanted to cut the film down from 120 plus minutes to 90 minutes? Can you imagine what this would have looked like?
I get that impulse, you know, there's so much complexity to it and so much nuance. And I get the desire to be like, we got to streamline this thing, or, you know, like average Joe is not going to bring his kids to see it. But like, it would be a travesty to have done that.
I am glad that didn't happen. But I think, like you said, there's so much going on. There's so many themes that are being presented here. And Jigo is the only one with a very simplistic point of view. He's like, I want to get paid, and that's it. So he's probably the closest thing to a villain.
He's very cynical.
Yeah.
I think he's the least, other than Ashitaka, obviously, I think he's the most morally straightforward kind of character, in that he's just a true cynic. You know, like, there was a line that stuck with me where Ashitaka asks, I believe it's when they're in, you know, like the inner sanctum of the forest spirit at one point, and there's some conflict, and Ashitaka says, can't humans in the forest live in peace? And Jigo just says, whose side is he on? As if he can't imagine someone who's only out for the greater good, you know, like,
right.
He's just like, huh, what's this guy driving at? Like, what's his angle? He just can't comprehend.
That's the fascinating thing about it. And the same thing with San, in some way, could also be seen as a hero or a villain. She
absolutely
murders these villagers. You know, she has no remorse for what she's doing. She's protecting her forest. Mm-hmm. And there is a sense that Miyazaki is building these complexities into all of these characters to kind of represent the sort of losing battle that seems to be being fought here. It's right. The creeping cynicism that we don't typically see in a Miyazaki film. It's the sense that things aren't going to turn out okay. These mm-hmm. characters all have their own goals that are justifiable. You know, everyone's going to get stained by something, and nobody's going to walk out of the situation unscathed. That to me is so, it makes the film so compelling. It makes the film so incredibly engaging, because at a certain point about halfway through, you start to realize, you're like, oh, I don't agree with Eboshi. I don't want her to kill the spirit of the forest, but I also understand why she's doing it. And, you know, you empathize more, I think, with San and with Ashitaka.
For sure.
But at the same time, I think the film very early on sets you up for this painful kind of, like, no one is going to feel good about what happens at the end of this.
Right.
It's actually kind of surprising that no one really dies except for San's mother, but none of the human characters are killed. Eboshi is injured. She loses an arm. That's about it. Everyone kind of, despite the harrowing things that happen, everyone kind of emerges at the end intact and alive.
That's true. But yeah, I agree with you that there definitely is just some pain kind of just built into the way this film is made. Like, no one is getting out of this without losing a piece of themselves. And one line that I don't know if it's exactly the same in both versions, but that really struck me from the subtitled version was in that early scene where Ashitaka is being cast out of his village. The oracle says, we cannot change our fate, but we can rise to meet it. And I kind of feel like that's sort of key to this notion that nature's purposes and humankind's purposes are often in contention with each other, and nature's going to do what it does, and people are going to do what they do. And, you know, that's kind of the conflict that we're fated to play out. But hopefully we can transcend that and sort of find some sort of way to peacefully coexist.
Yeah, it's not, again, it's not fully pessimistic. There's anger here, there's bitterness here, and there's a sense of despair in a way that, you know, in order for mankind to succeed, the forest spirit has to be killed, you know?
Right.
We can't necessarily live in complete harmony with one another. There's always going to be this one side gets a little bit of an upper hand over the other side, and that sense that, you know, can there ever be harmony? But at the end, there is almost a embracing of differences. It's almost the film's ending is almost, I wanted to ask you how you felt about it, because it's almost comically clean in the way they end everything. It's almost like after everything that happens, the terrible destruction, the spirit of the forest is killed. But then everyone kind of within the span of 10 minutes is like, all right, well, San and Ashitaka are like, well, I guess we can't be together, but I'll always think of you. I'll always remember you, and stay in touch. All right, great. And then everything kind of concludes. It's really, I wanted to ask you what you thought about the ending and if it felt abrupt or if it worked for you.
It worked super well for me, surprisingly. I totally see what you mean, that it feels a little too, you know, neat and tidy in the span of like 4 or 5 minutes. But I think part of what worked for me is that there's a shot where the forest spirit has kind of collapsed into that death goop, and it kind of washes over everything, and you see just the wreckage that it leaves in its wake. And then there's that long shot on just like this arid landscape that just slowly starts to regrow and turn green. That moment just feels kind of unstuck in time for me, in a way where it's almost like everything before it was a dream. You get Ashitaka and San waking up in this tall grass, and Yakul, Ashitaka's loyal elk, who is maybe my single favorite thing in the whole movie.
I was about to say Yakul. Who, like, can we form a Yakul fan club? Yakul's
the
best.
When he got hit with an arrow, my heart skipped a beat.
I know. But I always get so emotional when San needs Yakul's help to bring Ashitaka to the forest, and she's basically like, you can leave, and Yakul is just kind of like, what you talking about?
Yeah, why would he just stands there.
You know, that sense of like, she's like, you can go, you're free, and he's like, I'm good. It's very moving.
Yeah, but you gotta love his loyalty.
I don't even know what we were saying. Yakul just derailed everything, I think.
We were on the ending. I think that, you know, the way Ashitaka and San kind of wake up in that field and realize what they have to do, it almost makes everything that came before feel a little dreamlike. And, you know, I think that for me, kind of just that implied like warping of time sort of helps it not feel rushed or abrupt. But I really loved the way everything got tied up. That's maybe probably why it works for me as well. That Ashitaka and San, you know, they know deep down they have different priorities fundamentally. You know, Ashitaka wants balance ultimately, and San, you know, sees herself more on the side of the natural world and can't just live with people. You know, she's thinks that she's not quite human and has been raised that way, and can't suddenly live that way. I love that they don't end up together. I think that really is, you know,
I love that too. I think that was something maybe on the first viewing that I was like, oh, but they love each other. What's going on? And something, right, again, that I've appreciated in subsequent viewings, because it just wouldn't be right. It is kind of funny, though, that the film, the two characters end up not really all that different from what they were at the start. It's not conventional storytelling at all. I know Miyazaki, this is one of the funniest things. So when they screened the film at one of the festivals in America that it premiered at, the English version of the film, Miyazaki introduced it by saying, with Princess Mononoke, I intentionally threw out all the rules of entertainment movie making, which is why it will take some time for a true evaluation of this film to emerge. I hope you will enjoy all of the ridiculously long 2 hours and 13 minutes. That's how Miyazaki introduced this film. But I was struck by the fact that at the end of the film, you know, a lot of times in storytelling, you say, oh, the whole point is that the character goes on a journey, and by the end, he's fundamentally changed from what he was at the beginning. But neither, right, San or Ashitaka are all that changed. Ashitaka is back with the town and he's back with his own people. San is basically like, well, I can't be with people. I'm going to stay in the forest, which is what I was doing before.
Right.
But somehow that doesn't matter because the journey they've both been on has been so affecting and life altering in a way. It doesn't bother me. I wanted to ask you also about the relationship between San and Ashitaka, which I find to be a really profound and beautiful love story, especially because they don't end up together at the end. It's like they both needed each other for this period in time, and they both, well, clearly always mean something to each other. How did it work for you?
To your point just now, I think it's almost more resonant that Miyazaki chooses to not have them end up together as they might in a conventional film, because it's as if they're more valuable to their communities separately than they are together, you know, having like a insular romantic relationship. So I kind of love that.
The greater duty is like, we can't, I need to do this. This is just what has to happen.
Exactly.
I'll always care for you, but I have to, duty calls.
Right. The balance of humankind versus nature is ultimately the most important thing. But yeah, I really like their story. I love how Ashitaka is kind of just thunderstruck the first time he sees San. She makes a hell of an entrance. It's pretty incredible.
I know. I love that.
Where she's sucking the blood out of Moro's wound by the river. That is pretty intense. But I just kind of love the way that Ashitaka, you know, is just instantly aware that this is a noble person, you know, who is doing what she's doing for the right reasons. And, you know, he saves her life when she tries to kill Lady Eboshi. And then, you know, she saves his by bringing him to the forest spirit. I kind of just love the way they bond through crisis like that. And
then it's like he like you said, he saves her from killing Eboshi. And she's like, what are you doing? This is the whole point. And he's like, this is not the way. And she is furious. And she's like, I hate you. And she stabs him.
Yeah, she's about to kill him.
And one of the most beautiful things about Ashitaka's character, again, these things that on paper, you would read it and be like, well, who cares? But you see it and you witness it in the power and the context of the film and the story. But she stabs him and his reaction is to hug her. It's a beautiful moment. It's a powerful moment. It is so profoundly, like, it's almost the thesis statement of the film. It is Ashitaka's character completely summed up in just a single moment. This whole movie, he's been beaten up and he's been like everyone's fighting each other. And all Ashitaka wants to do is like, why can't we all just get along?
It's like the thought of an explosion is so impossible to him that he doesn't see any reason why he shouldn't jump on the grenade. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Any, he will make any personal sacrifice if it means some greater good will come out of it. I feel like he's a vehicle for the best of us, the way that Jigo is a vehicle for the worst of us. You know, I feel like both of those characters are to some extent Miyazaki saying, you know, how he thinks we need to be and how we cannot afford to be. Just cynicism versus, to a level of naivete. Like, Ashitaka nearly gets himself killed in the very beginning of the movie, you know, through his heroism. So it's like, clearly this guy is much too noble.
He's on one extreme of the spectrum. Yeah,
absolutely. And then Jigo's like hiding behind Lady Eboshi to even kill the forest spirit. You know, he's so cowardly.
I love that. It's the idea that Jigo is so slimy. He can't even do the job himself. They hire Eboshi. They manipulate her so that she'll do the work for them. Right. Again, all these people are being manipulated by these outside forces. And then it's just the way it all culminates and comes together and the way they intersect and what the result is, the explosive result of just all these misunderstandings and a complete lack of willingness to listen to one another. It's telling. And I think especially in this day and age, as we see a lot of factions of people who are very quick to jump on the gun and point fingers and shout and yell. Watching this film in the current landscape felt very therapeutic, almost like a reminder of like that it's so important for all of us to at some point just kind of take a moment and listen to each other or be willing to talk. Otherwise, we're going to kill the spirit of the forest and nobody wants to do that.
Nobody except Jigo. But yeah, I mean, I think one of the big takeaways for me was the importance of unity and balance, whether between man and nature or between man and man. A lot of the film consists of people or animals who should be on the same side, just bickering with each other over, you know, relatively minor differences and kind of losing sight of the bigger picture, you know? So the ape tribe and the boar tribe and the wolves all have, you know, different ideas about how the forest should be protected. And they aren't really able to work together because they don't stand together. You know, they each have their own thoughts about how things should be done, and none of them can really bridge that gap between their two tribes and bring everyone together. You know, Princess Mononoke, she tries, but
yeah, I never thought about that. That is an interesting point, that the animals themselves are not even really unified in their causes. And again, the Lord of the Rings vibes I get from this movie are, it's the sense of this is the passing of an age, like it's right. inevitable passing. In the same way, kind of the elves in Lord of the Rings are sort of like, all right, well, we have to leave no matter what. Like yep. that's the vibe I get from Princess Mononoke and the forest spirit. But it doesn't make it any less depressing.
Yeah, it's still hard to watch it happen. But yeah, I mean, Moro essentially pulls that same move where she's like, I have this bullet in my chest, you know, my time is nearly here. And then when the forest spirit comes in and takes her in Okoto, you know, she's ready.
What are the other moments that caught you off guard or caught you by surprise? I know the one that still, like, I just remember being so shocked was the fact that they killed the forest spirit, that they actually succeeded in doing that.
I was surprised by that as well. When Lady Boshi takes the first shot at it and it goes right through its head, I was like, oh, yeah. So if it's going to die, it's going to die right now. And it doesn't. And then as it's transitioning to the Nightwalker, for some reason, that transitional state, like, makes it more vulnerable, and she shoots again, and that's what does it. I was surprised by that as well. And I love that moment where Lady Boshi has her rifle aimed at it and the forest spirit turns and plants start blooming from the rifle.
Yes. It's all planning. It's planning, literally. The idea that it's like, oh, everything's going to be okay. And then she literally blows its head off. It just felt so, like, purposeful and so shockingly violent. Definitely. That it was just like, this is awful.
Absolutely. I read that moment as saying, you know, nature has its own kind of steady progress, but it's like fundamentally that gentle sort of growth can't stand against just the brute force of machines. I mean, the one thing that I went into this really looking for was what we discussed in the first half of the episode, which was, you know, just the general sense that this is a more adult film and that it's, you know, more dark, more violent. So there were some scenes, particularly early on, that I was just like, holy cow, I've never seen something that violent in a Studio Ghibli film. Namely, where Ashitaka shoots a guy's arms off with an arrow and pins them to a tree. That was unreal.
Yes.
And he does it a couple more times, too. He's like decapitating people with arrows.
It's just the norm in this movie. It's like Miyazaki's like, eh, screw it.
Let's go for it.
We're just going for it. I do love, there's that one super badass moment where later in the film he's getting shot at and he catches one of the arrows.
That is so cool.
Uses it in his bow and takes out one of the guys. That's just
what,
like,
they get for shooting Yakul.
That's what you get. Didn't you see he just beheaded one of your friends? That's when you say, you know what, we're good. Yeah. We're good. We can go away. We can go home. We can be fine.
There was a really fun little, like, almost Venom-like thing going on with Ashitaka, how, you know, his cursed arm has a mind of its own and at one point wants to kill, like, he has to physically restrain it from killing Lady Eboshi, and you know, it gives him all this power, but it's still got a mind of its own. I thought that was really fascinating, and just like what the curse represented is something that I thought a lot about.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know about you, but I kind of interpret it as, you know, the curse that he has, and also that Nago and eventually Okoto, both of the boars, I kind of just read that as hatred. You know, Ashitaka says at one point that, like, fear and anger will only make this worse. I believe when he's breaking up the fight.
And then he also says when he's breaking up the fight, like you said, he is talking to all the villagers and he said, this is what happens when hatred takes over, this is what it looks like. So I think you're right. I think it is the kind of the embodiment of just pure unadulterated hate. Like when hate consumes you, right. What happens? Like it just you die. You can't survive with just pure hate running through your veins.
That's what it's kind of what I like about it, is that, you know, it makes you powerful. Like Ashitaka almost has superhuman strength at times, but it also is always slowly killing him. You know, something about that kind of trade-off. You know, people who choose a life where it's a life of hatred, there's got to be a reason why they do that, but it also obviously is not sustainable. Just having all that anger and fear in you is just going to eat you up.
Yeah, and I mean, despite the despair, despite kind of the darkness and the grim underbelly of this film that is just kind of permeating here, there's so much beauty in the film. It's so it's
visually stunning.
What stands out to me, those scenes where Joe Hisaishi's score is playing out over montages of Ashitaka with Yakul riding over mountaintops with these beautiful backdrops. I remember that moment watching it and thinking to myself, why would I ever not love this movie? Like why would I watch this and not see, like, be just completely blown away by like the majesty of it? That really is the film is majestic. It's
really
constantly
is.
It is very clear with its intentions. It's not coddling you, like you said. It's very clear that it's like there is good and there is bad, and sometimes bad things happen to good people, but it's never outright cynical. It's never outright it's never outright despairing. It never makes you don't feel miserable watching Princess Mononoke. You feel this sense of, every time I watch a Miyazaki movie, I'm like, all right, where's the nearest nature trail? I just want to go on a walk. I want to sit by a creek or something and just enjoy nature. That's the overriding sense I get from Princess Mononoke, is the grandness and the beauty of nature and the importance of preservation, even if there isn't an ideal way for mankind and the forest to commune with one another or to coexist in a wonderful way. There is this sense of like, maybe there is. I don't know. I don't walk away with a feeling of despair from Princess Mononoke.
Strongly agree. You know, I know the exact shot you're referring to of Ashitaka on Yakul, and you know, just the score is swelling and just how beautiful that is. It reminded me a lot of Zelda.
Yes.
You know, some notes that the score hit were just similar, and just the whole vibe of the world that they create, and Ashitaka is a hero at the center of it. Really reminded me of Zelda. And Princess Mononoke's mask also is, you know, nearly a dead ringer for a Deku mask.
I was thinking of that too.
That hit me, you know, right where I live, because Zelda's maybe my favorite game franchise ever made. So that, you know, brings some like sort of nostalgia and just warmth to it all. That's, you know, a little bonus.
I think Breath of the Wild, I was reading, I don't know how intentional it was, but I mean, it has to be, but some of the design choices with Link early in the game, the outfits you're wearing are very similar to what Ashitaka wears.
I saw this too. I saw some side-by-sides, and I would imagine it's deliberate. I mean, it seems like it couldn't not be.
So as far as like where this ranks with other works, what is interesting about this, I think we both talked about Spirited Away beforehand, which Spirited Away is probably my favorite Miyazaki film, with Princess Mononoke being a close second. Mm-hmm. And possibly tied. I mean, they're practically on the same level as far as I'm concerned.
My initial thought was that this is neck and neck with Spirited Away, as far as just how big and sweeping and epic and beautiful it is, and how stuffed it is with ideas and just how it makes me feel. I really think it's 50-50 for me. You know, I'm due for a revisit of Spirited Away, but this was just as immediately undeniable to me of what an accomplishment this is.
It's hard. I mean, it's very hard to pick between the two. I think Mononoke, you could maybe some of it feels a little more plotting, I guess, than Spirited Away. Like Mononoke is a bit more plot heavy than Spirited Away. Spirited Away is a little bit more harkening back to earlier Miyazaki, in that it's got an overall driving arc, but there are like periods where it's just like, look at how bizarre and crazy and kooky this world is, all these little vignettes within the main story, whereas Mononoke is very focused. Even though it's sprawling and epic, it does have a sense of like we're all leading up to this one point. So I guess the plot machinations could be seen as bogging it down, but I don't.
You could, you know, on the flip side of that, you could make a similar yet also opposite case that with Spirited Away, you know, the goal is so clear. You know, she wants to get her parents back. And that kind of having that in mind kind of allows for more wandering where, you know, you still have your eye on the ball and you know where it ultimately is going to be going. Whereas with Mononoke, he has this clear goal in the beginning to find the source of this iron ball that cursed Nago. But once he finds the source, things just keep complicating and, you know, his goal kind of changes, you know, repeatedly. So I think that's the flip side of that coin, that at least Spirited Away, there's a clear end point that they are working towards.
You're right. And it's completely different kinds of movies. Like if Princess Mononoke is an epic tale and grand epic fantasy, Spirited Away is very much in the vein of like it's a fairy tale and it's, it's smaller, more intimate almost. And but, you know, Princess Mononoke does not lack for intimacy. It feels very character driven. It feels very in tune with the beating heart that is like almost overwhelming at times in the best possible way.
One department where Spirited Away absolutely trounces Princess Mononoke, and, you know, comparing it to other Ghibli films, my biggest complaint about Mononoke is the lack of those trademark Studio Ghibli food scenes. You get one decent eating scene with Ashitaka and Jigo eating rice around the fire.
And that's it.
But Spirited Away, true. it's a visual feast.
I think we just put our finger on it. That's got to be it. That's got to be why people don't. It's the food. You need more food in a Miyazaki movie.
There's something just so soul fortifying about the meals, like the gigantic meals in Spirited Away. I love them so much.
Well, what are as we're wrapping up, what do you think is maybe the standout moment for you for Princess Mononoke? The moment that really, like, for you cements its reputation, its standing with you, its personal meaning for you?
One kind of overlooked moment that I wanted to be sure we talked about is the scene where Ashitaka has just been revived by the forest spirit and he's kind of coming to slowly and he's very weak, and Princess Mononoke chews his food for him and regurgitates it to him. I just thought that moment was so, like, tender and beautiful, and kind of it made me think that human, you know, think about that, what really divides humans from being animals. And I loved that that moment just kind of blurred the boundary a bit and was true to Mononoke's, you know, feeling like an animal more than a person.
I wrote a note down that is, true love is someone chewing your food for you.
That's exactly
I think
right.
That's, but I that's another moment that gets me, when she's doing that for him and then when he starts crying, just that sense of utter despair. Again, I think when we talk about Ashitaka and his pretty straightforward nature, there are moments like that that instill him with such humanity, where it's not like a situation with other characters of the same ilk where they're just kind of noble throughout and they don't experience any doubt or things like that. In certain stories, you do get the sense of this very human person who is really suffering, and that moment of despair contrasted with that real moment of human compassion and caring is so, you know, there is a stigma around animated films with people who don't watch them or haven't seen Miyazaki's works, where you think, like, that's kid stuff. It's fine, I guess. But, like, I challenge people to find me moments that resonate and feel as powerfully moving as some of the things you find in Princess Mononoke and Miyazaki's other standout works.
One other moment in the film that really was big for me was just the climactic moment of giving the forest spirit his head back. I just thought that that image of Ashitaka and Princess Mononoke standing together, their whole bodies covered with that curse, corruption, you know, sacrificing themselves to do what's right and to restore the forest. I thought that was really beautiful, because, especially because Jiko is standing right there. And, you know, he's this guy who the whole film, when he's been in it, is espousing all of this cynical stuff. Like, humanity being defined by its desire to control everything. He says something about, you know, what would people be if not desiring to control heaven and earth? You know, he thinks they're just in it to kind of overrun everything. And I feel like the ultimate refutation of that is Ashitaka and San, you know, putting their lives on the line to restore the forest and be selfless and, you know, be unified together. You know, just the counterpoint to all that cynicism and to all the bickering and infighting that we talked about earlier that prevents like balance from being possible. I just thought that moment kind of was thematically as explosive as it was.
It's a powerful way to end that. That whole sequence when the beheaded Nightwalker is just destroying everything. I just remember when you see the Kadamas just start falling from the... I know, when the Kadamas just start falling from the tree, it's like, well, great. How could I possibly feel worse? Yes, it's the most adorable creatures in the entire film are now dying en masse and right in front of you.
I love those guys. Little like egg timers.
And they show up at the very... That's, again, why the movie is not cynical or depressing, despite its tragic overtones. You have that one little moment of hope where one of them walks out into the scene, the final shot of the film.
I love that kicker.
It's great. It's a beautiful moment. But yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that too.
One other like great little grace note towards the end of it is just before that final shot of the Kodama, you see Jigo looking at everything that's happened, and he just kind of shrugs and says, "I give up. You can't win against fools." And I thought that was just so great that at the end, like, you know, he's the closest thing to a true villain that we have. And at the end, he can't even see, like, he thinks they're the fools, you know, like, I just love that he is like, oh, well, I've learned nothing.
Nobody learns anything. Princess Mononoke, unconventional. Nobody changes. Nobody learns anything. Best movie ever. This has been great. I'm so glad we got to talk about this movie. I'm so glad you enjoyed it, that it lived up. It sounds like it lived up to your expectations.
Absolutely. And then some. I really loved it.
So what do you think our rating system should be? I'm leaning towards, I think one of the best moments in the film is when, at the beginning, when you first see the Kadamas and Ashitaka is carrying the injured man through the forest and they're piggybacking, the Kadamas start piggybacking as well to give him a little boost in energy and confidence and reassurance. So how many piggybacking Kadamas would you give Princess Mononoke, with one being the lowest and five being the highest?
I'm giving it the full five.
I'm giving it the full five. It deserves it.
My ranking would be 0 to 50 feral hogs. Giving it the full 50, the feral boars.
It's earned every last one of them. Well, Scott, thank you again for giving me the opportunity to revisit this wonderful film. And if people want to chat with you about your discovery of Princess Mononoke and pick your brain a little bit more, where can they find you out there on the interwebs?
On Twitter, 24 hours a day at @PScottRussell.
I'm at @YeSeanDoorman on Twitter, at Sean Doorman on Instagram. I think this has kicked off another Miyazaki marathon for me. I need more Miyazaki in my life, and this has been the perfect way to do it. But I want to hear from all the other Miyazaki fans, Studio Ghibli fans. Yeah, I want to hear some more thoughts about Princess Mononoke, where it ranks, how does it compare to Spirited Away or some of Miyazaki's other works, what works about it, what doesn't. Let's hear all about it. Scott, thank you again, and we will catch you at another time, everybody.